so far away.
This is the Maggie Dawn Show. My name is Jim Santel. I'm guest hosting Maggie's show today. Thrilled, delighted to have you with us. And by us, I mean my wonderful producer, Anya, and my other producer here, Jess. We're in the studios of Civic Media, and as always, we're taking your inquiries, your questions, your comments about some of the subjects of our discussion on this, our Thursday broadcast here on The Maggie Dawn Show. Delighted, as always, to involve you in our discussion. Our discussion up to this point, including this major Supreme Court case issued just hours ago, finding constitutional the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau 7-2, justices agreeing, with the exception of the two, including Sam Alito, the CFPB continues to be funded properly. It is constitutional, pushing back on its attack by others that would suggest that it was improperly put together, improperly funded. And then also recalling not only the history of that, but other cases out there yet to be decided that are also a part of the Supreme Court's addressing the future legitimacy of our agencies generally, the importance of those cases coming up, certainly be reported on this, The Maggie Dawn Show, and others on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. We know today that Michael Cohen is continuing to testify under cross-examination right now of defense counsel. We talked a little bit about that, recognizing that he himself has a lot of burdens, a lot of baggage there, being exploited appropriately by defense counsel, can test his veracity. That testimony may or may not finish today, may go into early next week. The court not meeting tomorrow, Monday and Tuesday of next week, highly likely the case will rest. The prosecution will conclude by that time. And then it turns to the defense if Donald Trump and his attorneys, if at all, want to present a case. Entirely possible that by next week at this time, the jury could be deliberating in anticipation of a verdict. The first time in American history that a criminally convened jury, a jury convened for the purposes of a criminal case, will be deciding the fate, the criminal status of a defendant, presumed innocent until such time as ever as the government proves its case beyond a reasonable doubt. All of that going on today in America and right here in the state of Wisconsin as well, as our listeners and our supporters continue to call in to this, the broadcast station of Civic Media. Delighted to have all of them with us. Calling in from Madison is Nick. Nick, glad to have you with me this afternoon. Thanks for calling.
Hey, glad to talk to you. And this might be an unpopular opinion, but I am not a Trumper at all. But I'm a conservative. And I just think that when we look for wolves and then all of a sudden they weren't actually wolves, but then when a wolf shows up, no one cares. That's kind of what I feel about Trump.
All right. Well, again, you know, on this broadcast station of Civic Media, the labels don't mean as much as the substance of your comments. And as always on this show and others, Nick, we appreciate perspectives. I've always said, as has Maggie, reasonable people can disagree about reasonable things. And that's what you're articulating, right? That's also America, right? That's the reason why we have not only radio shows like this, but opportunities for us to discuss not just of the First Amendment, but engage in discourse that advances things in a way that are material. It is through that process. I've just been commenting on the importance of this adversarial system inside the courtroom. You can make the strong, compelling argument that the history of America is premised upon disputes with people with whom you've got legitimate disagreement, but not ugly disputes and not violent disputes. We can disagree, as people often say, without being disagreeable in the way in which we do that. That makes our country stronger. Nick, I appreciate your comment. I appreciate the perspective that conservatives and liberals and people all across the political avenue and the political geography bring to this. Appreciate your call this afternoon, calling in from Nick. We also have calling in from Madison, Dick. Dick is on the phone as well. Dick, thank you for calling, being a part of our broadcast today.
Well, James, I understand in the case of Michael Cohen, I'll put it bluntly, you're kind of trying to polish a turd. But that said, and I got this sinking feeling that there's going to be just one person on that jury that, oh, this not beyond a reasonable doubt and blah, blah, blah. Would it then go to a retrial? And if so, what's the percentage of winning in a retrial? Is it better? Is it worse? I don't know. But
sure.
I don't know. For some reason, I have a bad feeling about this.
You've got a feeling, Dick, that this jury is not going to return a clear verdict. And so let's talk about that. Really appreciate the question. This is perfect law school stuff, but it's also civics things that everybody should understand. You don't have to be a lawyer to appreciate the very good question that you're articulating here. You're absolutely right. You have put it fairly graphically what the prosecution trying to do. I won't repeat that particular phrase, but I agree with you generally that the prosecution has a burden here when it comes to Michael Cohen. He is not an especially attractive witness, and that's putting it mildly. Lots of things there to dislike about him, and that's one of the challenges that we'll hear about in closing argument. The issue you raised, Dick, then, is all about what happens after this goes to the jury. A couple of things, actually three things could happen. One is the jury, after some period of time of deliberation, again, that is not a public proceeding, as we all know. We will not know what the jury is talking about. They will go into, not seclusion, but into their own jury deliberation room to make decisions about what they just saw over the period of the past several weeks. Three options coming out of that. One of them is that they return a verdict of guilty. There are 34 counts here. Now, they could return a verdict of guilty as to one, as to 11, as to 22, as to all 34. My own view is that this is either an all or nothing kind of a case. If you find that there has been fraud when it comes to the New York laws and the violations of that, you'll either find the defendant completely guilty or not. It's probably unlikely the jury, they could, I suppose, parse through the three packages of counts, one of them having to do with the checks. Maybe they find the defendant guilty of those, but not the registry issues, not the invoices. Highly unlikely they will do that, but they could return a verdict of something as to some or all of those counts, in which case, as you know, the case then proceeds to sentencing down the road. The judge will do that, and yes, it is the judge who presides over the case who had sentenced Donald Trump. Each of those counts carries with it a 5-year possibility of imprisonment. Highly likely, but frankly, impossible to believe that when you do the math on that, that a defendant in this stature and in this status, never previously convicted of a crime, would get anywhere near that kind of exposure in a sentencing proceeding. But that will happen down the road. That's option number one. Option number two is a complete acquittal. The jury could come back and once again say, would have to say unanimously, as it would have to say if they find unanimously a verdict of guilty as to all counts, got to be unanimous. If the jury comes back unanimously and says, yes, we find that the defendant did not commit any crimes, that none of these counts has been proven by the government beyond a reasonable doubt, we find unanimously all 12 of us that the government has not met its burden of proof, and for that reason, we are finding the defendant not guilty. That's also an option, in which case, within minutes after the return of that verdict, what does Judge Merchan do? He dismisses the proceedings, and he discharges the defendant from further proceedings. It is done, and there is no appeal from that. There is no appeal that the government can take under our system of laws, under the Constitution. That would be double jeopardy for all kinds of reasons out there. There is a third option, which really, Dick, is what you're articulating here, and that is that if among that 12, during the course of the deliberation, whether it's next week or the following week, whenever that happens, the jury decides in one way or another, all the counts, some of the counts, but there is one person or two people or three people or more than that who simply say, we cannot decide on some of these counts, one or more of them. And the jury is hung. The jury is hung when it comes to some of the counts. That then will mean that the jury will return to the courtroom and report to the judge. Again, a couple of options. Even inside a hung jury, they could say, we can't decide on any of the counts, all 34 of them. We made no decision whatsoever. We cannot reach an agreement unanimously, in which case the judge will indeed declare a mistrial. That's what it's called. And the government then has the option to try it again, which we'll get to in just a few seconds or so. The other option, of course, would be that the jury could come back and find that the prosecution has proven its case as to some counts, but as to others, they could acquit, they could find not guilty, and as to yet others, they could also find that the jury simply cannot reach a verdict. As to those counts in which there is not unanimity, again, the judge would declare a mistrial. As to those counts alone, even though as to other counts, there are convictions. That's a lot. That's a lot to take in. That's going down the civics road big time here on our Maggie Dawn show here on the Civic Media broadcast stations. But that's the options. Those are the options that are out there. And if indeed the jury comes back in whole or in part, cannot make a decision, the judge then declares a mistrial. And as to any counts that are not the subject of a dispositive, unanimous verdict, guilty or not guilty, the government then has the option to retry the case, and yes, indeed, you start over. Now, in the federal system, that happens very rarely. In the state system as well, it is rare. It does sometimes happen in all systems, but the decision is then made by the prosecution, but whether or not to do this a second time. My sense is that Alvin Bragg, if he gets a hung jury as to all counts, he would almost certainly say, yes, indeed, we're going to retry this case, go down this road once again, and open up all the process, all the procedures that have been before Judge Merchan up to this point. Lots of different options here. We'll see, Dick, if your concern, your prediction about there being one or two or maybe even more members of that jury who simply will not come to a verdict on one or more of the counts, or maybe even all of the counts. That is a possibility. My own sense is that the prosecution has presented a compelling case here, undeniably a compelling case. And for that reason, there should be some capacity, even amidst this amazing charge, to a jury to deliberate on weeks of evidence, to apply the law to the facts, and to come back, if they can, unanimously of a verdict. I think they can do that. The predicate is there. This is a strong case, and it is one that the jury plainly will deliberate on in their judgment, return a verdict as to whether or not Donald Trump, the first president, former president ever in our nation's history, is guilty or not of these violations of New York law. The Maggie Dawn Show continues as we discuss more here on this show about what's happening in America today. Stay with us for all of that.
I'd rather spend it being close to you, but you're so far away. Doesn't anybody stay in one place anymore? It would be so fine to see your face at my door. Doesn't help to know. Don't see it showing. Why do I?
This is the Maggie Dawn Show. My name is Jim Santel, guest hosting at Maggie's invitation. Very much pleased and very much thankful to her to give me this opportunity to chat with you. Also thankful for our callers who are calling in, dropping texts in the Civic Media app. We appreciate all of that. The conversation continues here on the Maggie Dawn Show, when we're also featuring throughout this afternoon the spectacular, wonderful music of Carole King, a lion, an icon in American history, American music as well. Being enjoyed right here in the studios also by Anya and Jess, my wonderful producers, who again, with me, inviting your involvement in our discussion. Yet a third major thing happening just yesterday and today, some fallout coming out of this particular decision, as they always seem to be, and that is that President Biden just announced through the Attorney General and directly from the White House as well, that he is invoking a concept called executive privilege. Executive privilege. We have heard a lot about that in the past. And indeed, presidents, almost all presidents in our lifetimes, have also invoked it. Republicans and Democrats alike, to prevent the disclosure of information. The concept is generally that when the president, the chief executive of our nation, is engaged in conversations, is engaged in things that are deliberative in nature, that are, for the most part, confidential during the course of the creation of policy or directives, that those conversations should not be the subject of future disclosure. Why? Because if you know while you're talking, while you're giving advice and counsel, and maybe even arguing with the president about what should or should not happen, you don't want to chill that conversation. You want to make certain that people feel good and candid and have the ability, the capacity to talk frankly with the chief executive without the concern that down the road, those very graphic and candid conversations will be released, all sorts of other things in the general area of executive immunity in which the concept has also been applied, yes, indeed, by virtually all presidents of my lifetime, including President Trump, including President Obama, including the presidents who have preceded them as well, sometimes successfully, sometimes challenged in the courts, and sometimes not successfully challenged in the courts as well. President Biden, yesterday and today, asserting this concept of executive privilege to deny the House of Representatives, in particular the leadership of the House, House Republicans, access to recordings of his interview, that is the investigative interview, with a special counsel, and his name is Robert Hur. You may recall this well, Robert Hur, appointed by the Attorney General to investigate whether the current president, Joe Biden, in his possession and acquisition and continuing possession of documents that he took from the White House, ended up in his Delaware home and another office in Washington, D.C., whether that decision to take those documents, that acquisition, the discovery of those documents, in itself violates federal law. You may recall that there are several investigations of this. One of them, yes, that's right, involves Donald Trump, the past president, presently on trial, not for that, but in the Mar-a-Lago documents case, that particular investigation about his acquisition, his transfer, his possession of documents, the subject of a discrete federal prosecution pending in the Southern District of Florida in front of a federal judge. Her name is Eileen Cannon. She is in a courthouse in Fort Pierce, Florida. That case, as you know, going ahead. Executive privilege, also a part of that. Also a claim of immunity there, which is a somewhat different concept, but the president raising that issue today in the context of the investigation of him that resulted in a finding of earlier this year that the president had not engaged in any criminal conduct in connection with his possession, his use, his transfer of these documents. You may recall that there was another investigation of the former vice president, his name, of course, Mike Pence, documents discovered in his home in Indiana. The question was whether or not those documents discovered in his possession could form the basis of a criminal prosecution. Once again, the Department of Justice finding that as to both Mike Pence and Joe Biden, no criminal conduct, no criminal intent, possession of documents that they should not have had, certainly, but no findings of criminal culpability. A report issued again by special counsel, his name is Robert Hur, a United States attorney, finding no criminal culpability. Well, in the wake of that, the Congress asking the Department of Justice, and yes, indeed, these investigations are overseen by the Department of Justice, even as special counsel works on them, a request to the Department of Justice, ultimately to the White House, to release, as I said, the recordings of the interview that the president, Joe Biden, gave to Robert Hur and his staff as a part of that special counsel investigation of his handling of those government documents. And the issue here is whether or not the release of the recording, not of the transcript of the interview itself, that has been released. That has been released already. The question is whether or not Congress and this committee itself should get the recording of that conversation. This particular decision announced just yesterday is intended to shield, in many ways, the Attorney General, his name is Merrick Garland, as you know, from prosecution if the House Republicans succeed in holding him in contempt for refusing to turn over the audio of Joe Biden's conversation with the special counsel, Robert Hur. The Attorney General, speaking briefly with reporters outside his office, said that the bid by Republicans was the latest in a series of unprecedented, and he said, frankly, unfounded attacks on the Justice Department that included efforts to defund the special counsel prosecuting former President Donald Trump. An issue here raised, lots to unpack there, by the Attorney General accusing again the political folks on Capitol Hill from using this request for political purposes. Later on Thursday, the House Judiciary Committee voted 18 to 15 along party lines to approve a resolution recommending holding the Attorney General in contempt of Congress for refusing to comply with their subpoenas demanding this recording or all the recordings of the interviews that were undertaken at that time. Now, all of this going on, again, in the midst of a continuing political fight, if you will, between the Congress and the presidency, you may recall well that this particular report, again, the transcript of which has already been produced, is material that can be used, presumably, during the course of the present political campaign. You recall well that this transcript and the report issued by the special counsel a number of weeks ago, a characterization of it, of the president, the current president, as an elderly man with a poor memory. And it certainly provided some valuable fodder to the opposition, to Joe Biden's campaign, to the Trump campaign itself. Plainly, the request, not for the transcript, that's been released. The report itself, also a part of this release, exonerating, finding no criminal conduct here as well, but also finding that a lot of what the special counsel determined was the product of an elderly man, once again, with a poor memory. All of that, a part of the public disclosure to this point, that is what gives birth, if you will, to this request for the recordings themselves, plainly to further advance this interest in showing on a partisan political basis that the president is indeed this elderly man with a poor memory, not the view of me, not the view of many other people who look not only at the report, but also the conduct of the president on a daily basis. But today, executive privilege being invoked by the president to prevent the disclosure of these recordings into the public domain and into the political arena. Lots to unpack there, lots to think about as the campaign continues, lots to consider further as the Maggie Dawn Show continues this afternoon on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. The Maggie Dawn Show, featuring this afternoon the spectacular music of Carole King, an icon in American history, American music history as well. Thank you also to our callers calling in. We're going to get to more of those in this hour as well, talking right now about this major invocation by the Justice Department, by the White House, of this concept called executive privilege, bandied about a lot in our present parlance, and also invoked by virtually every other president recently. So what is the upshot of all this? Well, we know that the Attorney General has said that invoking that concept, he is not going to be producing the audio of the interviews conducted by the special counsel into whether or not the president improperly, illegally held on to, used, transported, had in possession some documents from his time as the vice president. And so on a regular basis, the Department of Justice will examine these kinds of things, make determinations about when to invoke the concept and others as well. Very often in this administration, Merrick Garland has made the attempt to try to figure out a way forward without running afoul of the Congress. Not this time. Today's action by the White House, by the Department of Justice invoking this, is a dispute between branches of government. The first article, of course, of our Constitution, legislative branch. The second one is the executive branch. They're fighting right now over this very notion. It is not a constitutional crisis by any means, but it is what our Constitution contemplates, that there will be disputes between the parties and they will be subject to checks and balances. The decision now by the Attorney General to invoke this principle leaves it now to the members of Congress, the Republicans there, to determine whether or not they want to pursue this in the courts. Significantly, we get some of the reporting on this that indicates that they may or may not do all of that. One of the reasons for their asking for the recordings of this, as opposed to the transcript, of course, is, as they've said, that Biden's words are not as good as hearing them. That was a justification for their requesting these tapes in the first place. They say the transcripts do not reflect important verbal context, such as tone or tenor, or nonverbal context, such as pauses, or pace or delivery. Again, Merrick Garland in many other situations like this has attempted to try to find some middle ground. Not this time. The Republicans, again, the folks who are asking for this, and today their request rebuffed by the White House, by the Department of Justice, have also said candidly that they need the audio to examine the president's mental acuity. And that, again, refers to the decision, the writing by the special counsel about the president as being forgetful. And they suggested that along the way that all those things might also have impacted his decision, that is the special counsel's decision, not to find that there was any criminal liability here at all. In fact, as we have repeated here today, what her report found was that there was some inconsistent evidence along the way, nothing to indicate that Joe Biden had willfully retained classified information without authorization. That evidence, at a minimum, fell far short of what would have been necessary to prove that what he had done is in violation of the federal law. And again, Herr found that the evidence was also consistent with very innocent explanations for the president's, at that time, the vice president's actions. Similar findings with respect to the vice president and the disclosure there about the retention of documents in Indiana. Same kind of thing. No indication whatsoever that there was any criminal intent here. Innocent explanations all around. Again, a big difference between that and the willful, intentional, purposeful allegations against Donald Trump that are pending right now in that federal district court in South Florida, that being presided over by Judge Eileen Cannon. That case, almost certainly not going to trial anytime soon, not in this calendar year. But again, today, significant in terms of constitutional disagreements and the sparring between branches of government invoking this all-important principle called executive privilege, sometimes the subject of a lot of review by the courts, oftentimes endorsed by the courts, sometimes not endorsed by the courts. We'll see what the members of Congress, now rebuffed in their request for the recording, will do as this matter goes forward. As always, the Attorney General explains his behavior. He says, "The only thing I can do is continue to do the right thing." This is what Merrick Garland is saying in announcing this decision. "I will protect this building and its people." And notice what he says. This building, he's talking about the Department of Justice. They're on 9th and Constitution. I worked there for about 2 years in the Janet Reno administration. He's talking about the institution of the Department of Justice and its people. And that's where the executive privilege aspect comes in. Note what he doesn't say. Note that he says he's not invoking this privilege on behalf because the president told him to do that. This is not prompted by Joe Biden calling up his attorney general and saying, "Don't release that, invoke this." This is a decision by the attorney general doing this on behalf, as he said, this building, which is a word, a term for the Department of Justice, the aspiration for justice, which is its purpose, and the people who animate, who populate the Department of Justice on a daily basis. That's the invocation of this principle, this privilege being invoked today. As always, appreciate your calls, your comments, and we've got more of that. Delighted to have Carmela from Milwaukee calling in to be a part of our discussion this afternoon on the Maggie Dawn Show. Carmela, thanks for your call.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, Jim. I think you just explained it before you went to commercial break. I was like, no, wait a minute. Who is invoking what? And isn't this silly? Because the transcript is his answer or his replies. And even if he had hems and haws or whatever, it really wouldn't matter what the bottom line is with what his answer was.
Right.
You explained that further. And then I was confused. Now, who is fighting this? But then you just explained it too, that Merrick Garland is doing this at his office. And Biden did not ask him to do this. So he's going against Congress. And it sounds like Congress is the one invoking, insisting that if you hear the audio, that it's going to take down Biden, that he's a feeble old man and doesn't know what he's talking about. Is that where
Carmela,
they were going with
you
that?
Have described it in a way in just a few moments there in a way that I have not. You got it just right. Absolutely. That's precisely what's happening. It's being invoked by the attorney general here. Yes, indeed. It does mean that the disclosure of the interview tapes, the audio, will not be a part of the public domain by virtue of this invocation. But your first comment is also the all-telling comment, too, which is you've got the transcript. You've got the transcript. And the transcript, by the way, also includes, as would any transcript in court, any interview, all the ahs, the ums, the I don't knows, the those kind of non-words that often fill our language. All of those are there. Oftentimes, a court reporter will even put an ellipsis into indicating that there may have been a pause during the course of the testimony, the questions back and forth. And that's exactly the attorney general's position. Listen, we've already produced, members of Congress, this transcript. It tells you the substance of what you're asking for. And Carmela, you identified, as did the Republicans, candidly, exactly the reason for this. This is not a part of any further information gathering purpose here. This is for the purpose of political movement forward to try to advance this unsupported notion that the acuity, the sharpness, the intellectual vigor of the president is not what it should be. It's for political purposes. And that's why the attorney general is saying no. And that's why he is contesting this request. We'll see what the Republicans want to do. They could bring this into court. But once again, one of the challenges, Carmela, in their doing that is that Donald Trump has himself invoked the privilege on many times during his presidency on similar, not the same kinds of factual predicates, but he's done it himself, as has Barack Obama, as has George Bush, both father and son, as has Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter. And all of our presidents of recent times have always invoked this in appropriate circumstances when the merits of it justify it. And that's what would be argued in court. And so, Carmela, again, you've got it just right. The political entrance, if you will, of the fact that we are in the middle of a campaign entering into the decision about whether or not to disclose this audio tape, invoking again this legal principle of executive privilege. Appreciate the clarification, Carmela. Perfectly done. And well questioned here on our broadcast. Thank you so much for that. Jack is calling in from Merrimack. Jack, appreciate your being a part of our afternoon broadcast as well.
Thank you, Jim. Carmela kind of put it the same way I would have. This whole thing is to politicize the verbal answers. And I can see the Republicans taking this, not just using the entire recording, but I can see them taking it easily a step further, taking individual sections completely out of context,
right,
and saying, yeah, he has, you know, paused here, he hesitated here, he's trying to think of an answer here, you know, and so on and so forth. It's the reason why Hunter Biden, for instance, wanted his interview with the House committee to be on the public record instead of held in private. Right. The whole idea of it is to try and damage Biden again, even, you know, continually doing this, just as it would have been to try to use Hunter Biden in a similar fashion.
Exactly. Precisely the same kind of thing. And again, you think about the reason why an attorney general who, again, in a proper administration, should be arm's length from the White House. What is your purpose? Why are you doing this? Well, it's because you want to protect not only the institution of the executive branch, but you want to do it based upon facts and non-political, non-partisan purposes. As you've just indicated, Jack, as Carmela just did as well, stating it even better than I have, the purpose behind this is plainly partisan. It is embarrassment. It's an attempt to embarrass. And presumably, that's the reason why. That's the identification, that classification of this. When the attorney general says, I'm doing this on behalf of the Department of Justice, he's talking about much loftier, greater things beyond the partisan aspects of our lives that he should not be involved in. And that animates this perfectly. And you got it just right, Jack. That's what this is really about. Plainly, probably not the end of this particular issue, but could be and should be as we go ahead. Jack, appreciate your calling in there from Merrimack, being a part of our conversation this afternoon. We also have Tom calling in from Grafton. Tom, thanks for being a part of our afternoon broadcast.
Hi, I'm glad you're filling in for Maggie. You're doing a great job. My point is this. I had heard that the contents of what was the president had in his controller at his home was actually his personal notes and nothing else. There was no documents or anything like that that people would like to lead you to believe, but it was actually just his personal notes. And to me, that does not sound like a big deal.
Yeah, Tom, and you raise a good point. All of these things are mixed, right? The issue about exactly, you know, what you do and do not have, whether they're classified or not, the great majority of those things, again, not classified in all in these cases, including the Donald Trump situation, right? And the question is whether or not you purposely, intentionally took these documents for some, I will say nefarious, that's not the legal term necessarily, but some inappropriate reason. Did you take them and are you banding them about, as is alleged in the Trump indictment? Did you take them for some reason that's not legitimate, that's not in advancing the interests of government? Joe Biden and presumably Mike Pence as well said, you know, I took some of these documents. They were plainly anticipating, as they have done, talking about and putting together their own memoirs about these things. And even though the special counsel in both of those instances find, yeah, you shouldn't have taken those. They should not have been processed in the way that you took them from official offices. You shouldn't have them. There are ways for those documents to get there. The reality is there's none of that intent. There's no inappropriate purpose. There is simply a personal purpose reflected again in the personal notes that you're making reference to, Tom, makes great sense. All of that, a part of the continuing discussion, again, not only of executive privilege, but about the differences between the Biden and the Pence situations and what Donald Trump continues to face in South Florida. We continue our discussion here on the Maggie Dawn Show as we go forward in talking about the law and government and justice in America. This is the Maggie Dawn Show. My name is Jim Santel, sitting in for Maggie Dawn this afternoon, appreciating so much our callers, as Maggie does also on a regular basis, animating our discussion, making it fuller and more rich for not only your understanding, but mine as well. Always benefit from discussions on the radio and outside of the radio, as well as we often comment. That's what our nation is all about. Discussion, even across political lines. Even when we disagree with each other, always use the comment, always invoke the phrase that reasonable people can disagree about reasonable things. It is those unreasonable things, and they may be less numerous, but those unreasonable things where reasonable people should not be in disagreement. And we've also talked about some of those. In that connection, also mindful of something else that's happened. Not so much in the political environment, but actually the journalism environment of recent times. We know from recent history that a number of journalists recently have begun to codify for all of us, putting together in one place, in one publication, in one digestible format, the kinds of things that a second Trump administration would convey. And so you may recall well that Atlantic Magazine, not too long ago, published a major version of its magazine called If Trump Wins, discussions by many scholars across the board in all political aisles about everything but about immigration and climate and science and China and the courts and abortion, history, partisanship, civil rights, the military, and general America character. As they describe that in that magazine. Others have done the same. And yes, indeed, most recently, Time Magazine has also put together its own version of it, not bringing together the writings, the historic writings, the learned writings of people across partisan aisles, but following up on and codifying an interview with Donald Trump himself. Time magazine sitting down with the president, the former president, perhaps the future president as well, and talking with him about his vision for the next presidency. And it's under the heading, If He Wins, and it is put together by a journalist there inside Time magazine named Eric Cortalesa. And Mr. Cortalesa describes, among other things, all of those things that the previous journalists have also codified. We have seen a lot of this in a major product of the Heritage Foundation called Project 2025. We talked about that a lot on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. We have talked about some of the components of that. And again, all these major areas that would dramatically reshape the nature of our nation, and describing in those settings the sweeping expansion, not only of presidential power over the machinery of government, but really reshaping the structure of the executive branch to concentrate far greater authority directly in the hands of the presidency, sometimes referred to as the unitary executive theory, this notion that the president actually has far, far greater authorities under their constitution than has been exercised in recent times. Well, Time magazine has revisited some, not all of that, but has revisited some of that in connection with reporting on an interview with Donald Trump himself. And the significant thing about all of this reporting, not just by Time magazine and Atlantic magazine, others have done this on all sides of the political aisle, is that they come directly from the words of the president and people, his so-called surrogates, who describe what a second term would look like. And among the things codified, again, most recently in this Time magazine article, is the emergence of, in two interviews conducted by the journalist with Donald Trump, conversations also with some close advisors and confidants, were the outlines of what many people have described as an imperial presidency that, again, would reshape America and its role in the world domestically and in terms of our foreign engagements. Among other things, describing during the course of this described interview in Time magazine, the plans to carry out a deportation operation designed to remove about 11 million people from the country. He'd be willing to build migrant detention camps and deploy the United States military, both at the border and inland, to accomplish all of that. Among other things, he would let, in some states, monitor women's pregnancies and prosecute those who violate abortion bans, which, again, we know are on the move, not only in places like Florida and Arizona, other places around the country. According to this interview with Donald Trump, he would, at his personal discretion, withhold funds appropriated by Congress, according, again, not only to his own words, but those of his top advisors, a thing called impoundment, impounding funds directed for release and by execution by the executive branch, something that Richard Nixon did during the course of his term. Again, according to the interview of the past and perhaps the future president, he'd be willing to fire a United States attorney, close to my heart, close to my mind as well, who doesn't carry out his orders to prosecute someone. And again, what would that do? It would break a long-standing tradition of an independent law enforcement that dates from America's founding. This is James Madison kind of stuff. This is George Washington kinds of things. This is the first attorney general. We've talked a lot on this broadcast and others about the necessary separation, did just earlier this afternoon, between the White House and the prosecution branch, which is the Department of Justice. Donald Trump saying to Time magazine that he would direct U.S. attorneys to engage in prosecutions that are not supported by the law and the facts and would fire those who fail to do that. He is weighing pardons for every single one of his supporters accused of attacking the United States Capitol on January 26, 2021. Something in excess of 800 of them have pled guilty, convicted by a jury. He might not come to the aid of an attacked ally in Europe or Asia if he felt the country wasn't paying enough for its own defense. And yes, he would in many ways gut the U.S. civil service, also something near and dear to my heart and to the hearts of and minds of thousands of people out there, thousands of people that you rely on day in and day out. Yes, indeed, those are the civil servants. Those are the experts who bring every day their expertise, their hard work, their insight in all of those federal agencies who do the work of America. he would undermine, gut the civil service, and through the exposition and codification of something called policy number F under the civil service, a specific order they actually signed at the end of his last term. The Biden administration overturned it very quickly. But as a result of that, the civil service also compromised. All of those things additionally codified in the annals of our journalists out there, including Time Magazine, as we look to the possibility of a second Trump administration, as we think in this calendar year about the campaign just ahead of us, including the convention in Milwaukee, the Democratic convention in Chicago, and the campaign for the presidency between the two candidates who are going to define one way or another what the future of America is all about. I thank Maggie Dawn. I thank the staff of Civic Media for giving me this opportunity, for coming to your homes and your offices for this discussion of America in 2024. And I invite you again to join me for Amicus Law Review on the coming weekend.